From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We decisively demand the dissolution of the U.S.-led coalition and for member states to withdraw from it.
That was the foreign minister of the Syrian Arab Republic, Walid Mualim, speaking with a reporter from RT in Sochi, Russia on Wednesday. The foreign minister of that war-torn country demanded the dissolution of the U.S.-led coalition, which claims it is fighting ISIS in his country. Mualim said the operation is nothing but a facade for Syria's destruction by ISIS. RT's Jacqueline Voga has more.
Apart from just demanding the dissolution of the U.S.-led coalition, the Syrian foreign minister also accused the alliance of destroying everything in his country except ISIL, the terrorists that they're meant there to be fighting, adding that he believes that Washington is using the coalition's actions to actually prolong the war in the country. Let's take a listen.
Thousands of Syrian citizens have become victims of U.S. airstrikes in Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor provinces. Not only men, but also women and children. Besides that, the American coalition systematically destroys economic infrastructure. That's why we decisively demand the dissolution of the U.S.-led coalition and for member states to withdraw from it, as it's obvious the U.S. is using it as a cover-up for the destruction of Syria, a maximal prolonging of the war.
Now, those comments from the Syrian foreign minister were made during talks with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov. Let's take a listen.
The activities of U.S.-led forces raise many questions. In some cases, these forces have indirectly encouraged other terrorists to attack strategic positions rightfully regained by Damascus, or they have deliberately engaged in bloody provocations against our forces.
On Wednesday, the Russian Defense Ministry actually claimed that 300 Islamic State terrorists in pickup trucks freely passed through a zone in Syria's Al-Tanf region where the coalition has a base and has determined an explanation from the U.S. side. Given that in the past, any advancement on that base or any movement in that area has been met with very strong reaction from the U.S., but these militants seem to have passed through untouched. Additionally, in the end of September, the Russian Ministry of Defense released aerial images which they said showed U.S. Army equipment in outposts near Deir ez-Zor that had been held by ISIL just days before. And the problem is there was no indication, no signs that fighting had taken place in the area, indicating that the locations had possibly been taken without force. Plus, of course, no patrols were obviously being conducted, again indicating that the U.S. forces felt safe in that area. Theoretically, if they just taken those locations from Islamic State, there would be the fear of them coming back in attempt to retake them. But no patrols being conducted, encouraging the speculation that the U.S. may have had some sort of understanding with the terrorists, that a simple handover may have taken place. And of course, we contacted Central Command asking for an explanation or at least some sort of comment on the images. They flat out denied the claims, adding, however, that they would not and could not comment on the locations of their coalition forces. Right now, one of the coalition's main fights is to push ISIL out of Raqqa, which is, of course, at this point, the de facto capital of Islamic State. But both humanitarian organizations and the UN have raised alarm over the number of civilian casualties that are being reported in Raqqa as the coalition continues to heavily bomb the city, where it's said up to 25,000 innocent civilians may actually be trapped at this point in time. So questions and objections have been swirling for a while now, especially given the fact that Washington was never actually invited into the country in the first place. So at this point, all we can do is wait and see what sort of reaction will be coming from the coalition.
Mualim's statement came a day after his country's permanent representative to the UN told a leading committee of the General Assembly that it needs to stop worrying about non-existent chemical weapons in his country and turn its attention to the hundreds of nuclear warheads that Israel possesses in the region. This was the permanent representative to the United Nations of the Syrian Arab Republic, Bashar Ja'afari, speaking at Tuesday's general debate on all disarmament and international security agenda items before the General Assembly's first committee for the current session.
Shukran, Sayyidi Rais.
Thank you.
I should like, first of all, to congratulate you for your election to the presidency of this important committee throughout this session. So the Syrian delegation would support the statement made by the distinguished representative of Indonesia on behalf of the non-aligned movement. We are meeting once again in an extremely complex and dangerous climate. The world is facing numerous challenges, including the development of existing nuclear arsenals and the threat by nuclear states, parties to the NPT, to use these weapons. Terrorism can be added to this. We have often warned against this, and it continues to grow and proliferate. Cutting down increasing number of innocent lives, sowing death and destruction, and hitting across the world tirelessly. The most worrying aspect of this is the adoption by certain states, including permanent members of the Security Council, of terrorism as a political weapon. These states sponsor terrorist groups appearing on the Security Council list, which use chemical weapons. President, Chair, the United States and Great Britain were not present at the NPT Review Conference in 2015. These two countries persist in defending Israel and Israel's possession of nuclear weapons and its non-accession to the NPT in clear violation of all the provisions of the NPT, which is part of the untruthful nuclear policies adopted by these two nuclear states. The fact that the United States, the UK, France, Canada, Germany, Australia, and other Western countries continue to defend Israel's nuclear program and to contribute to its development and promotion by defending Israel against all traditions of disarmament at international level has encouraged Israel to defy international opinion and develop its nuclear arsenal and not to accede to the NPT. Against this backdrop, my company reiterates its call to all member states to work towards making the Middle East a nuclear weapon-free zone and a zone free of other weapons of mass destruction. I should like to recall the initiative which we launched at the end of 2003 when we were permanent members of the Security Council. This was an initiative which we continue to call upon the Council to adopt. We also call for pressure to be exerted upon Israel to force it to accede to the NPT as a new non-nuclear party while subjecting all its nuclear activities and installations to the control of the IAEA. Chair, the government of the Syrian Arab Republic firmly condemns the crime of using chemical weapons. My country has acceded to the Convention on the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons because of its belief that in the Middle East should be a nuclear weapon-free zone, or rather, a weapon of mass destruction-free zone, to prove to the entire world our attachment to go against all use of chemical weapons. My country, Syria, has honoured all its commitments resulting from its accession to this convention and has complied with its obligations despite our difficult circumstances. These facts have all been confirmed by the President of the Joint Commission, OAEC, Sigrid Kaag, in the resolution of the Security Council in June 2014. The terrorist groups in Syria are still obtaining toxic chemical substances that they prepare, assemble, and use with the aid of the intelligence services, as known by everybody, against civilians and the military in my country. Some states sponsor these terrorist groups and continue to give these groups orders to use toxic chemical substances in order to make accusations against the Syrian government. The latest was the Khan Sheikhoun incident in a pitiable attempt to blackmail the Syrian government in international organizations. In the context of our constant and transparent cooperation with the IAC, my country addressed to the Secretary General a letter calling for a technical mission, an independent technical to be sent to Ram Shihun and to the Ashwehara airfield to see what happened on the ground in a global, transparent and integral way. We're not surprised, however, by the pressure exerted by some Western states headed by the US, UK and France to prevent the technical mission, the independent technical mission of the OPCW from being sent when this incident happened. They prevented it being sent to Ran Shihun and the airfield. And therefore, these states also prevented the mission establishing the facts, preventing the Ran Shihun visit and this airbase. We will use the right of response to respond to the Saudi Arabia representative. So, the Sheshlum Ahan Lasal visit was also prevented in August 2013. It is in the interests of my country that the truth come to light. The Syrian Arab Republic has sent over 124 letters to the Secretary General of the United Nations, the Security Council, the Joint Mechanism for Investigation, and Committee 1540, as well as the Committee Against Terrorism, the Counter-Terrorism Committee. In the first letter at the end of 2012, we mentioned the first chemical weapons attack against the village of Khan el-Hassal. We mentioned the chemical weapons 4 months before the first chemical weapon attack against Khan el-Hassal in March 2013. We stressed and expressed our fears that states supporting terrorism would provide chemical weapons to terrorist groups and then claim that it was Syria which had used these weapons. By way of these letters, we informed the bodies involved about the use by terrorist organizations of the use of toxic substances against civilian and military. They had transferred substances from Libya through the intelligence services of countries hostile to my country. This is on top of the provision in Nasra of aid from Turkish intelligence services, who provided chemical substances, toxic chemical substances, across the Turkish borders with the support of the Bandarban Sultan organization, a Saudi organization. We informed the Security Council Investigation Committee through various letters of the involvement of this group and that the fact that terrorist groups were given instructions to use chlorine and other toxic chemical substances in regions under the control of these groups. And we provided photos and videos to blame Syria.
Another confrontation between the U.S. and China in the South China Sea.
The Chinese government will take solid measures to defend China's territory and its maritime rights and interests.
That was Hua Chunying, a spokesperson for China's foreign ministry, in response to the U.S. warship Chaffee sailing into the South China Sea Tuesday.
China urges the United States to respect China's sovereignty and security, respect the efforts from neighboring countries to maintain peace and stability in the South China Sea, and stop such wrong actions.
Zheng Yibing is a correspondent for China's global television network He was at the press conference at China's foreign ministry and filed this report.
The Chinese foreign ministry has expressed a firm opposition to the fact that a USS-guided missile destroyer Chaffee sailed into the waters of China's Yisha Islands without approval of China on Tuesday. And China also lodged serious representations to the U.S. We noticed that the foreign ministry spokesperson Hua Chunying stressed China's stance during the press conference this afternoon. She also added that immediately after the trapezing of the U.S. destroyer, Chinese shipboard aircrafter was immediately sent to identify the U.S. destroyer and urge it to leave immediately. This is a recent case the U.S. warship sails into the territorial waters of China. In August, the USS John S. McCain destroyer traveled to the waters close to the reefs and islets of China's Nansha Islands without China's approval. For such incidents under the pretext of navigation freedom, China urges the U.S. to stop making mistakes. The ministry said that Xisha Islands has been China's territory, and in May 1996, Chinese government announced the baseline of Xisha Islands, which based upon laws. And this time, China warns the trapezing of the U.S. missile destroyer in China's territorial waters in Xisha violated Chinese and international law, severely harmed Chinese sovereignty and security, and seriously endangered the lives of soldiers at the front line. Observers recently commented that the White House is preparing for U.S. President Donald Trump's visit in China in November. And both countries share a lot in common in regional security, like the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Surely, strategic issues also like how to coordinate Sino-U.S. relations in the Asia-Pacific, especially in the South China Sea, will certainly be on the agenda.
Meanwhile, Carl Weinberg, the chief economist and managing director at High Frequency Economics at CNBC, said China has become a key player in the oil market since it overtook the U.S. to become the world's largest importer, and that Beijing is likely to compel Saudi Arabia to sell crude oil in yuan. This will severely hurt the U.S. dollar, he said. Weinberg was quoted as saying that Saudi Arabia has, quote, to pay attention to this because even as much as 1 or 2 years from now, China's demand will dwarf demand from the U.S., closed quote. In a 1974 agreement between then-U.S. President Richard Nixon and the Saudi King Faisal, Riyadh has accepted dollars for all of its oil exports. These are the so-called petrodollars. However, recently, China, Russia, and others have been looking to exclude the greenback from bilateral oil trade. Russia and Saudi Arabia are the most significant exporters of oil to China. China has already said it would like to start a crude oil futures contract priced in yuan, convertible directly into gold. Another key economic meeting took place on Tuesday in Sochi, Russia. The members of the Commonwealth of Independent States, a group that was set up shortly after the dismantling of the Soviet Union in late 1991, the meeting was chaired by Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who held a press conference late Tuesday.
Ladies and gentlemen, the meeting of the foreign ministers of CIS was held in a friendly atmosphere. It was very substantive. We had about 20 items on our agenda, and half of them will be then forwarded to be approved by the heads of state, and one item will be forwarded for approval by the heads of government.
СНГ на основе нашей концепции председательства, которая была распространена год назад и поддержана всеми участниками Содружества, за что мы им признательны. И реализация этой концепции совместными усилиями позволила продолжить курс на последовательное развитие организации, повышение практической отдачи от ее деятельности для всех государств-участников, упрочение позиции на международной арене и содействие сопряжению разноуровневых интеграционных процессов на постсоветском пространстве. На этом направлении
направленные и упомянутые мной решения, включая решение по актуализации полномочий высших уставных органов СНГ, а также Совета министров. Совета министров иностранных дел.
Agencies and structures.
Алло.
Происки, да.
Well, there's some problems with the microphone. Someone's been trying to subvert our press conference. So, again, this decision, as I said, was to update the mandate for several structures and agencies, including the Interior Ministry Commission, the Foreign Ministry Commission, and there are other other bodies to strengthen cooperation in law enforcement, cultural areas, and others. So we hope that a joint communique will be signed tomorrow by heads of state on the support of the institution of family. We believe that family plays a key role in social, civic, personal, and intellectual development of future generations. We focused on a number of issues in terms of cooperation and security. We approved two documents, the concept to counter money laundering of illegal legal gains, and the second concept on countering corruption. In terms of our military cooperation, we would like to adapt missile systems to be able to offer protection in terms of any space threats. We hope to finalize this work by 2025. And culture and humanitarian area have been our focus. 2019 will be the year of books, and 2020 will be another anniversary of the victory in World War II. Certainly we hope that CIS countries will celebrate this event in full and in style. This is our duty for generations who fought. So, and chairmanship now moves to Tajikistan. We wish them success and we'll be ready to assist them. The next ministerial summit will take place on the 6th of April in the Belarusian capital, Minsk, in 2018.
Слышно, да?
Слышно.
Добрый день, уважаемые коллеги. Я бы хотел дополнить кратко
выступление Сергея Юрьевича
как председателя Совета министров иностранных дел. И вот именно в этом качестве поблагодарить его за Констатирую, что исполнительный комитет,
the Executive Committee of the CIS and other bodies and structures have worked in close cooperation throughout the year. We have aligned our efforts with Russia's agencies and ministries, and specifically with the Foreign Ministry. We have managed to pass a number of landmark documents. Today, the Ministerial Summit approved two documents, and they will be forwarded to be approved by heads of state.
Кроме того, вы сами услышали из заявления Сергея Викторовича о том, что
Mr. Lavrov also said that we had a host of questions, including security, cooperation in the humanitarian area. We had a very friendly exchange of opinions, a frank one, and we
украинские представители сегодня не были на заседании.
We had to say that it's with regret that Ukraine did not visit the ministerial summit, but also has some statements from representatives of Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. They have reaffirmed their commitment to a more closer cooperation within the CIS. As chairman of the CIS Executive Committee, I can only praise and acknowledge the role of Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan in the Economic Council. And this has been unprecedented. 6 years ago, neither of these countries took part in the operations of the Economic Council. Right now, these countries are very active in drafting the roadmaps to strengthen cooperation in the economic area. And as Minister Lavrov said, Tajikistan will chair the group, and Russia and Turkmenistan will be co-chairs. And the ministers welcomed this decision, the readiness of these countries to actively cooperate within the Council. I'd like to praise the efforts by Russia, the Russian Foreign Ministry, the mayor of Sochi, the head of this facility. They welcomed the idea to host the ministerial summit here, and that's contributed to the success of the meeting. Thank you. And I would like to thank my colleague, Chairman of the CIS Executive Committee and his team. You know, it's been a challenging year. The CIS has been going through transformation. Heads of state passed a plan to adapt the union to new realities, and that soon envisages cutting costs and a more efficient use of existing resources. We'll continue to reform the CIS as an organization, and the executive committee needs to change too. Верти has been working really successfully, so please thank all of your team members. Thank you so much. We'll continue to work in the same way.
And we close with these comments from imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal about the situation in Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico, a colony by any name. On Christopher Columbus's second voyage to what was called the West Indies, he visited Puerto Rico, called Borinquen by the Arawak natives of the island. Columbus docked in November 1493, and with him came the force and greed of the Spanish Empire. For four centuries, Spain brought imperial exploitation, slavery, repression, and death to the Arawaks, and in its place arose a new people, the mixture of Southern Europe, Spain, the remnants of Indians and Africans. After the U.S. pushed a weakened Spain out of Cuba, it seized Puerto Rico as well. From that seizure of 1898 by the U.S. until today, Puerto Rico has been an American property under the U.S. government's thumb. Did you know that Puerto Ricans can't vote for president? That they on the island can't vote in general elections? They fight in every American war and die in every conflict. When U.S. businesses open up shop in PR, they are exempt from taxes. Money that could aid the island in its health and educational needs. And just days ago, after being lashed by nature's fury as Hurricane Maria, when they dared complain about slow American response, the moronic U.S. president called Puerto Ricans ingrates. Ingrates. Now, weeks later, they are still suffering. No water, no food, no power. They are Americans in name, but in fact, they are colonial subjects of the U.S. Empire. used by America, and then forgotten. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.